this, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. My guest today is Bob Harvey. Now, Bob spent over 25 years at St. James's Place Wealth Management, where he was responsible for growing the business in the Southeast. Prior to that, he held a number of roles within the financial services industry, so he really has seen a lot of change. Those who know Bob know he has boundless energy, and having stepped back from a full-time career, there was no way he could sit back and relax into retirement. So Bob went looking for a new challenge. He lives in Kent with his equally energetic wife, Sally, where they're enjoying traveling, staying fit and active, and spending time with their many grandchildren. In this interview, we discuss his 40 years in financial services and what's changed, his expectations of retirement and how that differed from the reality, the art of sales and why it's so important to learn this skill, and the importance of a healthy body and a healthy mind. We also then finish off with discussing his plans for the next 5 to 10 years. Enjoy. So, Bob, you officially retired on the 31st of December 2020. What were your expectations leading up to retirement, and how did the reality differ from that?
It's actually been a whole lot better. I went into retirement having worked it out for 57 years, and I thought, well, that's probably long enough. And I thought, was a good time to do that, but I had some concerns over what would I do, would I get bored, am I going to feel a bit like a lion in a cage, and I think the reality is that the first 4 months were pretty strange, because all of a sudden I'd gone from having a structure in my life to not having a structure in my life. So it was a bit of adjustment time there. And of course it was also at the time of lockdown. So I went into retirement in lockdown. So I couldn't even go on a holiday or anything. We were all locked down. So the first 4 months were an adjustment period. I decided that the way I would deal with retirement was to put in place a kind of a routine for myself. So I got up at the same time, I walked, exercise at the same time, and I put a plan in place that I wanted to have some, not that many gaps in my kind of life. So I went about looking for some charity work, some school work, and also to get back to the industry that I'd just spent the last sort of 40 years of my life in, which was financial services. So I spent the first 4 months, if you like, building my new life, and that which is now built by 4 months, and I just love it to death. I've got time to do things properly. I enjoy what I get involved in with 77 and some of the charity stuff I do. So it's actually been much, much better than I thought. But for me, the secret is building a bit of a routine.
And you talked about the gaps. And was it that you've gone from 40 hours a week down to a certain number of hours a week? How did you go about planning how that would look for you?
Yes, exactly that. I was used to working 60 hours a week, full on traveling to London, etc. I decided that I wanted to have 2 days a week where there was nothing there. So 2 days a week for stuff, because what happens in normal life is that you've got your family life, you've got your work life, and then things poke their head up and how am I going to fit that in? So I allowed a couple of days a week free, and they became easily filled up with some long walks, some exercise, and fixing this and fixing that. That's how I did it, really. I left a couple of days a week gap, and then I filled in other time around it. And I still, it's interesting that even though I'm retired, I still view the weekend as a weekend, and Monday to Friday are different from Saturday or Sunday. Whereas you could easily end up where the whole of the week feels like a Saturday and a Sunday. I didn't want that. I wanted a differentiator between the week and the weekend. And I still live just like that. And even to taking holidays, you know, when I take a holiday, I don't think about some of the stuff I'm doing back at the ranch. So I've still got that same mindset as if I were working. It's just that I'm not.
And how important was it for you and Sally that Sally also retired at the same time or a similar time?
Yeah, well, Sally retired 6 months after me, so that gave me a bit of space to sort out what I was going to do going forward. I think it was it's good that we both retired now because we can both do the same sort of things together. That would not have been as easy if she'd still been working and I was retired. That was very important.
Now, you said earlier that you've done 57, you've completed 57 years of work, and 40 years of those are with financial services?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. And then 25 years of those have been at St. James's Place. So you've seen so much within this industry. What are some of the changes that really stand out to you over your career?
Are you referring to the career with St. James's Place, or with
yes, or more broadly in financial services and wealth management?
I think what's happened is that the wealth management sector has become much more regulated and much more professional over the last 20-25 years. It hasn't changed the need for people to be given face-to-face advice, in my opinion. I think people still need to deal with somebody who they can trust and hopefully refer on to other people. But I've seen big changes in the products, in the amount of products, and the sophistication and flexibility of the products that weren't there 30 years ago, which is much better for the consumer. The consumer is more protected because of our industry being regulated, and the consumer is much more financially aware than they were 30 years ago. So it's been much better, in my opinion, for the consumer. And the actual financial advisor is treated much more of a professional person, whereas he or she 30, 40 years ago weren't. They were treated as people that sold things as opposed to giving advice. And that's a big shift, that we're now in an advice place as opposed to being product salesmen, which a lot of the other organizations were back in the 80s.
And do you think that's come about because of the increased regulatory requirements and the education requirements for advisors now?
I think it's come about because of the requirements from the regulator, but I think it's come about by two things. I think the general public have wanted that, but then the other interesting thing that's happened is I think because the advisors have taken this much more as a profession in their head, a lot of them have bought this about because they've wanted to get better. And they've wanted to be recognised by the outside world as a true professional bunch of people. So they have themselves brought this about, which is great to see. And now, you know, here we are where people are viewed by the community in the same kind of light as you would view any other profession, a solicitor, an accountant, an architect, whatever. Whereas 30 years ago, these people were product salesmen. So I think the big driving force has come from the advisors themselves, and they've driven this.
That is really interesting. And perhaps it has been this progression where those who were perhaps pure salespeople have left the industry, whereas those who view it as a profession have continued on and continued with their learning, perhaps.
I mean, that's exactly what happened. If a lot of people, when it became mandatory for people to have professional qualifications, many advisors decided to jump off the ship at that point and are no longer with us. But the people that remained and the new entrants coming through have all got the qualifications and looking to get more qualifications. So yes, that's exactly what happened.
So how did you start your career 57 years ago?
I'll give you the paperback version, otherwise we've been here for too long. I started out in the retail sector. And I started out initially working for a fashion retailer in the day, which is no longer with us now. It was called C&A, and it was a chain of stores. I started off there doing normal sort of shop assistant work. I then went into Tesco's because my father was one of the founding directors of Tesco's with Jack Cohen when they set up their first store after the war in Brixton Market. So I got into food and became a store manager at Tesco's at the age of 18, and that's where I started. What then happened was that I met my wife, Sally, all those years ago, and we decided to hop on a plane and go to Australia, just really to kind of see a bit of the world. I saw a job advert in the Telegraph for a company called Red S Stores, and they were looking for people to go out and manage stores. So I went out. To Sydney, and I got a job there. Didn't particularly like the job I'd got there, but it was involved in a large supermarket chain in Sydney. To cut a long story short, Sally's family at that point lived in Perth, so we drove across the Nullarbor Plain from Sydney to Perth. This was before it was surfaced, so it was a dirt road. It was a 5-day trip. We put some kangaroo bars on the front of the car and stone guard on the window screen and a couple of cases of frozen Foster's lager in the back. And we drove across the Nullarbor Plain and arrived in Perth. I couldn't get work there, and I always wanted to get into selling. That's what I wanted to do. Sally had found herself a job in one of the suburbs of Perth, a place called Subiaco. And I got a night shift. I was filling stores in the supermarket, and Sally was her cousin's house. And a man from the Prudential came round and said, "What does your husband boyfriend do?" And Sally said, "Well, not a lot, really. He's doing a night shift." He gave her his card and said, "Well, get him to give me a call." So his name was David Simpson, and he was one of the agents at the Prudential based in Perth. So I met David, and he said, "Well, what do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I quite fancy selling. I like people." He said, "Do you fancy selling life insurance?" So I thought, "Well, I'll do that until I can get a proper job." I did the various interviews and tests and exams and stuff, and got this job as a self-employed financial advisor. This was in 1975. And we were cold calling, knocking on people's doors, advising them on life cover and savings plans. Absolutely loved it to death. Really, really enjoyed it. And became very, very successful at that. Then Sally's father died. She got a bit homesick, and we came back to the UK in 79. And I then joined a company called Schroders, which was Schroder Financial Management. as a self-employed financial advisor based in Maidstone in Kent. I applied the same work habits and principles that I applied in Australia and been taught, and again became successful, dare I say it, myself here. So I was with them. I then moved into management, into unit management. That company got bought by an Australian firm, fun enough, National Mutual of Australasia, and it became NM Schroeder. The culture had changed a bit, and by this point I'd moved into sort of like full-time management, and I was the branch manager of a couple of their branches down in Kent. And I then got headhunted to go to a startup where Norwich Union was setting up a direct sales force, and I went to Norwich Union to help them set up this sales force in Kent, recruiting and building teams of people. I went on and did that. My boss there then went over to Allied Dunbar. He left there and went to what was then J. Rothschild Assurance, and recruited me across, and I joined what was J. Rothschild Assurance, now known as St. James's Place, in 1995 to run the Western office. And my brief there was to build the office, which I did. We had, when I took it over, we had 35 advisors, 10 of which we needed to suggest they did something else. And I then grew that from that then number of 35 up to 135 some 13 years later. And then I moved into the acquisition side, which is recruitment, where I spent my last eight, 9 years before retiring. So that's a kind of a very abbreviated version of what I've done. So all of my life in terms of financial services has been involved at the front end, which has been either recruiting people or advising on products. So has that given you enough detail?
Oh, there's so much there to unpick, Bob. So much there. I've written numerous questions off the back of that. So with your sales background, do you think that perhaps sales has been a dirty word for a long time, and now we're finally starting to see that sales is incredibly important and it's an art?
I think most people appreciate somebody making the purchase of something easy for them. And that's what selling is about. It's not, selling isn't about persuading somebody to have something they don't need or want. It's about making it easy for them to make a decision. And what we can't, as human beings, we can't help the fact that we buy people. People buy people. And our big job is to ensure that people buy us, not the product. So, yes, I think it was a dirty word. And the reason it was a dirty word is because people that were selling were just motivated by commission and with no regard to whether the products or services were going to benefit the person purchasing them. So yes, it was. But I think it's moved round, and I think people are now beginning to understand that actually they quite like the fact of somebody helping them make a purchase easy. And, you know, we've gone through this whole kind of do it online marketing. We need a face. We need somebody to look us in the eye and say, in my professional opinion, this is what you should do. Whether you do it with me or someone down the road, doesn't matter, but this is what I think you should do. And that's how it's been.
And you're always very dapper in the way that you present yourself. You're always dressed very nicely. And you mentioned there that people buy people. How important has it been to you that you come across very professionally and very well dressed?
People judge books by covers, and you need to present yourself in the right image. And I think it's very, very important that we feel good on the inside about how we look on the outside. So I think it's really, really important. And we pay attention to not just what we look like, but how we act and how we present ourselves with people verbally as well as visually. So I think it's really, really important to have the right look. And that's different for all of us. I'm not saying it'd be a pretty boring place if everybody wore the same color suit and the same sort of shirts and tie. So we need some individuality, but the individuality needs to represent the person. It's who that, you know, I could never wear a brown suit and brown shoes to work because it's not me. But for somebody down the road, it probably is. So I'm just saying that we have to feel comfortable in our skin about the image that we present and how people see us. And sometimes we forget that people are making those judgments on us, aren't they? And if you come to a meeting with somebody for the first time, that first 2 minutes of that meeting, the people have decided whether they like you or not. So in that first 2 minutes, it's probably even 1 minute really, it's not just about what you say, it's about what you look, how you position yourself, your stature. So it's really, really important.
There's a quite fine line between being looking successful to potential clients and looking like you're perhaps charging too much commission. And this has been a debate that I've had with many people over the years. But what do you think that clients think when they perhaps see their financial advisor arriving in a nice expensive car, or perhaps wearing a nice expensive watch and going on nice expensive holidays? Do they think, I'm glad that my financial advisor can manage their own finances? Or do you think, I'm paying them far too much?
I think it depends upon, you're absolutely right, Nicole, there is a fine line. I think people want to feel that they are dealing with somebody that is successful. I don't think they want to feel they're dealing with somebody that's got, that is very flashy. And it depends really upon who the client is. You know, if it's a business client, it's totally different to Mrs. Smith who might live at 6 Acacia Avenue. So I think we need to be careful over the image that we present. And often that's around the kind of motor car you drive and things like that. So we do need to be aware of it. But I actually think that people want to deal with successful people. And because our products now are transparent in terms of what the client is being charged and what they're paying, I don't believe it's an issue at all. It's about how we feel, really. And we need to feel comfortable in our skin about how we act and what image we're presenting.
And you spoke about your father being a co-founder of Tesco. That must have been quite incredible to grow up with your father in that position. When did you first recall how influential, let's say, your father was within the food industry?
Probably when I was around sort of 9, 10. I can remember every Saturday night was taken up with dad taking, each store had to ring their production figures in on a Saturday evening before they could close. In those days, we didn't open stores on a Sunday. So all their production figures were phoned through on a Saturday. So dad would spend up until 8 o'clock every Saturday night taking all these figures down. And then he had to ring them through to the board to say, this is how much business we've done this week. I can remember it then. Dad was pretty strict with us. And we, you know, whilst he was a founder director, we didn't live a privileged lifestyle because, you know, we're talking to the 1960s. And he worked an awful lot of hours. So I guess I picked up my work ethic and the way in which I, the views I have on how you manage yourself in life from dad. And he always used to say stuff like, you know, you've got two ears and one mouth. You use them in that way. You listen more than you speak. And a lot of people don't, do they? They just want to speak and not listen. And be a little humble. It's quite good to be a little humble. So I picked that stuff. Probably, in answer to your question, probably 9 or 10, something like that, I would think.
Mm-hmm. And having, you say that you lived quite a non-privileged, or that's sort of the term you used. Do you consider yourself to be better off than your parents were at a similar stage in their life?
I think I'm better off emotionally, because I just feel quite rounded emotionally. I don't think my mother and father were particularly rounded emotionally. They got on really, really well and had a great relationship, and there was no issues there. But my mum was a great warrior, and my dad was a little bit Victorian, I think. So I feel better off emotionally. Financially, yes, I think so. But I think a lot of us in this generation financially are better off than our parents, because the world's moved on, and you know, we've got technologies such as this that they didn't have. I think I'm better off in two accounts, probably emotionally and definitely financially. Yeah.
So apart from the strong work ethic, which is obviously a very important part of your life, is there anything else from your parents' experience that's influenced your attitude towards life?
Yes, honesty. The other thing that came out as a family group was about being completely open and honest with people. And if it was going to get you into trouble, it was going to get you into trouble. But you need to be honest. And if you start telling fibs, or if you start telling lies, you just got to keep telling more and more to hide up. So it's being honest, being open, strong work ethic. And then as I found my own way in life, after parents had died and stuff, there was things like work, you know, work hard and play hard. Both are really, really important. They kind of came a bit from mum and dad, but I sort of picked that up, where it's really, really important to work 8 hours and play 8 hours, and make sure you're not the same eight, you know, to differentiate when you're working and when you're playing. I think a lot of people, in terms of managing their life, fall down because they don't give themselves enough time off. And I don't mean time off physically from work. I mean time off emotionally, because it's important, I think, to be able to say, well, okay, I'm going to put all that aside. I'm now having some time where I'm not going to think about those issues. I'm going to put them in a box and put the box on the shelf. And then when I come back to work, I'll take the box off the shelf and take the lid off. And often the stuff that's in there has gone away anyway. You know, a lot of people, when they're on holiday or at the weekend or on their day off, they're not, their heads and hearts are still back at the ranch, and that's not healthy. So you have to, you know, you only get one life, and you don't want to muck it up by not giving yourself enough time to just take some time out. And you always, you know, you just put a different hat on, don't you? You know, I've got a work hat, and I've got a social hat. Sometimes I get a bit mixed up, but I try to segregate them.
Yeah, it is difficult, actually. And I like how you said that you work hard and play hard, but not the same 8 hours. That's really important. And it's very difficult, especially for people running their own businesses. And you've been self-employed for a very long time, initially before you became employed. And obviously, your father was a founder of the business of Tesco. So do you think that perhaps seeing him blend the work and home time potentially, or when you were starting out, you were blending work and home time? Is that what's helped form your view on that?
Actually, no, he was rubbish at it. Dad was no good at that at all. I guess I've learned from that. Dad wasn't particularly good at that. I've just sort of picked up as I've gone through life myself that that's really, really important. I'd like to say that somebody taught me that. They didn't. I just sort of picked it up. I think I've heard people talk about it, and I attended lots and lots of conferences and seminars in my early years in this profession, both in Australia and here. And a lot of this stuff I picked up from people that I see standing on stage that to me look like superheroes, but they were very successful entrepreneurial advisors. And this was, you know, I noticed that most of the really, really successful people seem to have a lot more time to do stuff than people that weren't quite successful. And a lot of the messages they would give out was all around, look, you know, you need to manage yourself, manage your life. And I just took it on board, and I've lived it, and it's worked for me, Nicole. So I think it's, but probably the, you know, if somebody said to me, what is the most important thing about your life that's got you to where you are, it's that ability to be able to segregate work from when I'm not working.
And with your trip to Australia with Sally, what did your parents think at that time, and her parents, when you said, by the way, I'm moving to Australia? It's not like it is now when I told my family at age 21, I'm moving to England. It's not the same as now. So what did they think? Did they think you'd gone mad?
I think we were both very, very lucky that they gave us our blessing to go. Bearing in mind that we'd only been boyfriend and girlfriend for 6 months. So we'd only actually been dating each other for 6 months. And I know that my parents were pretty pretty sad about it, but they gave me my blessing, and Sally's mum and dad were the same. So we were fortunate that they both gave us. It can't have been easy for them. But we did say to them, we're only going to go for a year or two, but it ended up being 6, but they didn't know that at the time. Yeah.
Do you remember your very first paycheck and how much it was, and who were you working for at the time?
Do I remember? That's a really difficult one. I can't remember. I can remember... I think my first paycheck when I was working at Tesco's was, I think it was like about £30 a week or something. I can't remember the exact amount. It was so long ago. I can remember when I came, it doesn't particularly answer the question, but it's on the same frame. When I came back from Australia, which was in November the 6th, 1978. I can remember looking at 1979, and I had two options. If I'd taken a job, a salaried job in those days, I would have been paid £10,000 a year. Or I could go self-employed, and I wrote myself a business plan to say, if I go self-employed and do this amount of activity, I could potentially earn $15,000 a year, like $5,000 more. That was massive, okay? And that's what I did, and earned the $15,000 and more. Sort of answers the question, but in a roundabout way.
And so no momentous big purchase with your first paycheck that you can recall?
No, it wasn't a big landmark in my life.
And has there ever been a time in your life that you have felt really hard up and wondering where the money was going to come from for the next, yeah, I don't know, rent payment?
Oh, loads of times. Lots and lots of times, because, I can give you some examples. When we came back from Australia, the first year back, we had a lot of snow. I decided to go self-employed. We got a 9-month-old son, and I had no salary. It was commission only. I had no clients because he wasn't given any clients, and didn't have any big family contacts. So the whole of the business was going to be coming from cold calling. And we were hard up. And I just worked harder. And the I remember going out and buying a pair of Wellington boots and decided to go cold calling in Maidstone. There was snow on the ground, and I just walked into all the shops in Maidstone saying, look, you don't know me. Here's my business card. I'm offering financial advice to people in the retail sector around their pension, superannuation and life cover. I just thought I'd offer my services initially. It's a free consultation. And I spent 2 weeks doing that and called every single shop and business in Maidstone and produced business from it. So you couldn't do it now because that kind of behaviour is frowned upon, just cold calling. But it got me out of a hole. It worked. And then I spent the first 4 years of my direct selling career in the UK cold calling businesses, houses, shops, just off a very, very polite, offering a service, and it worked for me. So yes, in answer to your question, lots and lots of times have I been skint. It's not a bad thing. It makes you value life, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the pounds that you earn when you do. Are you a spender or a saver?
I'm both. I like spending money. I like having nice things, but I also like to have a bit of a safety net behind me. Having said that, that's only been the case for the last probably 15 years. Up to 15 years ago, I'd spend everything that came in, not on me, but on the family and the kids and stuff. So, but now I'm both.
And what is your money weakness? Is there anything that you really can't resist spending on?
I like shoes. I like shoes. I like shoes and shirts, basically. They both give me this, don't they? Shoes and shirts and coats. Yeah, clothes mainly. Yeah, it's not big flash cars. It's not gambling. I've never gambled. It's not expensive wine. My weakness is clothes, yeah.
And you do look very good every time I see you, Bob, so it's clearly worth it. Now, this is a kind of an odd question to ask you, given the industry that you're in. But do you use a financial advisor or do you prefer to do it yourself?
I use my son.
Okay.
My youngest son, Luke, is a financial advisor and he advises me. And a good friend of mine is also an SJP advisor. As you can imagine, I've got SJP investments. So I use a combination of the two.
What about property? Do you invest in property?
We have over the years. We've had a couple of properties in Spain, which we bought and we lived in and rented out for a little while. We sold them because we were doing a house up back in the UK. We had a buy-to-let in the UK. We've subsequently sold them. So over our life, yes, we have had offshore properties, buy-to-lets here. We don't now. We just have our one main residence because that suits. We don't want to spend I don't particularly want to spend my time managing a property portfolio. I'd rather go for a run.
Yeah, exactly. And what was your best and your worst investment? Is there anything that stands out?
My best investment, or two best investments, probably the house I'm in now, because we bought it in the right position where it commands some pretty outstanding views of the English Channel. And we bought it at the time when the market was right and this property needed some work doing on it. And that's yielded us a big, big return. That was a good investment. That is a very good investment for us. And the worst investment would have been we bought a project, the house before this one, which was a money pit, and it was doing up an old property which commanded, again, had really nice views, but it was one of those projects where there was more work to do than we anticipated. Normal sort of story, isn't it? And we just sunk a whole load of money into it. We sold it and recouped our money, but we didn't make that much profit on it. It was just a purchase that we didn't think through long enough, I don't think.
So in your opinion, what is better for retirement, property or perhaps a pension or something else?
I think it's probably a blend of both of those is the answer. I think the pension is at the top because you've got the tax breaks that go with that. And you've got the potential for investment return. With the property, you don't know what's going to happen to the market. You've got the cost of maintaining a property portfolio and the time it takes to run it. Whereas it takes none of your time to run a pension, does it? You know, it's done by a company. But I think the answer is probably a blend of both of those.
Now, let's talk about you and your wellness and health and fitness. Obviously, you keep yourself very, very well. And you recently came back from a lovely holiday where you focused on wellness. And you mentioned going for a run, which I'm really impressed with, since I went for a run this weekend and can hardly walk now. But what do you and Sally prioritize as far as wellness and well-being in all its forms?
I think to summarize it, I think that it's the old kind of healthy body, healthy mind cliche. That is so important, isn't it? That if we maintain a level of fitness, then our whole outlook on life, everything is different. And I think that exercise becomes a habit, and over the last 20 years I've worked on making it a habit, so it now becomes just like people get up and brush their teeth. I have to get up and do some sort of exercise during the day, so I'm a big fan of it. I'm not a big fan of extreme sports and exercise and stuff. I think it's better to do gentle, so slow. I've done a couple of marathons, but I think slow runs, brisk walks, Pilates, yoga, gentle exercise, I think is really important. Regular just keeps the body moving, and to me it's fantastic. I think it helps you see the world in a different place, most certainly, if you have a decent level of exercise. And you know, the more you do, the more you want to do, and the less you do, the less you want to do, isn't it? And when I go on a holiday, for me, the best part of a holiday is my breakfast. And I only enjoy my breakfast if I've gone out and done a bit of a run. We just had a week in St. Lucia, and my routine was 7 in the morning, 6K run along the beach, barefoot, sand, obviously, come back in, shower off, and then I can eat as many eggs and bits of bacon as I want, so I haven't got to worry about it. But so for me, that's the highlight of my holidays, is that first start to the day. And it's nice enjoying a meal when you've done a whole load of exercise or whatever. And with weight, you know, what happens is that it can just gradually, you don't suddenly put 2 stone on. What happens is over a period of months or years, a little bit, and all of a sudden you go, cool, these are a bit tight now. So it's good to do that. We found ourselves, we found ourselves a bit heavier than we'd like to have been about 5 years ago. So we went on a gluten-free diet, and we read a book about gluten and the secrets in the word gluten, isn't it? It sort of glues everything together. So we went on a gluten-free diet for a year, lost quite a bit of weight, and actually I feel how much better for not eating. You know, we don't stick avidly now to gluten-free. We've eased back a bit on it, but I feel much better for having eased back on all the bread that just puts it on. So yeah, I think it's really, really important in your mental health, and with lockdown and all the issues that the world's throwing at us right now, mental health is something everybody's talking about. And actually, I think that physical fitness obviously helps mental health.
Yeah.
And so have you all esteem, doesn't it, and all that kind of stuff.
That's right. When you look good, it's right back at what you were saying at the beginning there. When you look good and you're presenting well, you feel good on the inside as well. And is this something, this fitness routine and this focus on your fitness, is that something that's been with you for all your life or something that's been more recent?
It started happening in Australia. At school, I was useless at cross-country running, PE. I was the nerd. I was no good at any of that sports stuff. I don't have a natural eye for a ball. So I'm no good at tennis, golf, cricket, all that. So none of that. It was when I was working in Australia, there were some people out there that were talking about the power of physical fitness. So I started running. Would have been 1976 and carried on since then. A bit like Forrest Gump, you know, just can't stop running. So my fitness thing started in 76 and here we are in 2000 and whatever the date, still doing the same thing now.
And what does that routine look like?
My routine now is that I go for an hour's walk in the morning with Oscar, my Cocker Spaniel, and that's every day. And at the weekend, I'll do that. Plus, if the weather's okay, I'll go for a run as well. And then every Tuesday, we do Pilates. So I do a Pilates class a week, and a walk during the day, and a walk and run at the weekend. So that'll do me.
Yeah. And clearly it's working for both you and Sally. You have boundless energy. And I think that's what's so important. It's, yeah, you look great and you're slim, but you also have so much energy and a great outlook. So looking forward now to the next sort of 5-10 years, what do they hold for you and Sally? We had breakfast recently and you were both talking about your plans for Australia and New Zealand. What else are you planning to do?
I'm looking forward to watching the grandchildren grow up. I'm hoping to continue at least for the next 3 years to carry on my involvement with 77 Wealth Management, where I'm involved with the advisor community and as a non-exec director to the board. I'm looking to carry on doing that. I do some charity work for an organisation called the Young Lives Foundation, which is an organisation that provides support to young people between the age of 8 and 18 that are at the risk of offending. These are some sad cases. I'm a mentor for those people. So at the moment, I'm mentoring somebody there for an hour a week. I'm going to carry on doing that. We're in the process of looking to move house at some point in the next 12 months. As you mentioned, hopefully a trip back to Australia to see how that's changed. And some good our old best mates live in New Zealand, so an Australia and New Zealand trip is certainly something that we're looking to do. Carrying on, sort of enjoying life with the way I'm living it now. So I'm hoping that I don't have to change too much, and just embracing this new world that we're in, and that's ever changing, and change is good. I like change.
Well, we wish you all the best, Bob and Sally, as well on your future. And I'm really enjoying working with you here at 77, of course.
Okay.
And looking forward to many more years of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seen it high completely, and they've done a great job kicking off.
I just wanted that lifestyle.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe, and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.